Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, Baseball Prospectus' local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes or our Blog Talk Radio page by searching for the Catbird Speaks. I'm Colin Whitchurch. We are recording on a Friday afternoon, joined as always by Nick Schaefer. What's up, Nick?
How are you today, Colin?
Not too bad. So, since we talked last week, the White Sox have made another big trade, sending Todd Frazier, David Robertson, and Tommy Kahnle to the Yankees for another package of prospects led by minor league outfielder Blake Rutherford, also minor league starting pitcher Ian Clarkin, and outfielder Tito Polo, along with major league reliever Tyler Clippard. Nick, we talked last week about the possibility of these other trades happening after Jose Quintana was dealt to the Cubs. I guess we were not expecting a big package together like this, where they actually got someone somewhat legitimate in return. Obviously, the package helped them get someone like Blake Rutherford, who I think probably sits just outside the top 50 on our Baseball Prospectus minor league list. So, were you surprised that they were able to pull something like this off? Do you like it?
Yeah, I remember as the day was unfolding, initially, you know, Frazier got pulled from the game. There was some hug watch stuff where he was hugging and high-fiving people in the dugout, and all the reporting had been Frazier to the Red Sox. It seemed as though there may be some sort of problem there in terms of money, because I know the Red Sox have been desperately trying to reset their luxury tax this year and get under that threshold so that, you know, because I think it stacks year to year, every year you're over.
Yeah.
And they dumped Clay Buchholz partly for that reason. So if the White Sox weren't interested in eating money, Frazier had about just under $6 million left on his deal for this year. So that may not have been the best fit, even though the Red Sox really needed a third baseman. So finding a team that was willing to take Frazier and Robertson and their contracts was together may have been a tough thing to do. And then you throw in Kahnle and take Clippard back to smooth things over and actually make it something where you're not just dumping salary, where, you know, these pitchers are, I think Robertson is slightly net positive and Frazier's somewhat treading water at that sort of price. So yeah, the Kahnle, I guess I was surprised that all three, to answer your question, all three went together to the same place, but it certainly makes a lot of sense when you step back and look at it, because, you know, the Yankees can still try to make the playoffs this year. Frazier solves problems for the Yankees either at third or first. And, you know, with Kahnle and Robertson in that bullpen is absolutely insane. And even if they don't make it this year, they still have Kahnle and Robertson for next year too.
Yeah, so it was kind of surreal watching it all unfold kind of over the course of that game on, I guess it was Tuesday against the Dodgers. And, you know, the reports kind of were trickling in, and everyone was watching Frazier in the dugout after he was a healthy scratch. And, you know, Robertson and Kahnle were in the bullpen for the whole game, even as people were saying, well, they're going to New York as soon as this game's over. But the interesting thing was, it seemed like, you know, the White Sox were in a perfect position, because even before those, okay, it's definitely New York reports happened, it seemed like it was a bidding war between the Yankees and Red Sox. And then there were, you know, it was kind of humorous to watch unfold, because I know, like, Bob Nightingale was reporting that it was, you know, the Red Sox were the front runners early in the day, et cetera, which a lot of people had. And then I think he had a tweet after the fact about how, you know, the Red Sox were never serious talks about it. And, you know, maybe it was just kind of, you know, leaking reports to drive up the price for their rival Yankees. But either way, I mean, yeah, like you said, the fact that they packaged them all together was surprising. It also, you know, once the Quintana deal happened, we kind of figured, okay, they're obviously going to make more trades, but they're done getting kind of top-end returns, because, you know, once Sale and Eaton went during the offseason and then Quintana went last week, that was the end of their kind of elite level talent to trade. You know, you have the, as good as Robertson is, he had the fact that he's still owed a lot of money. you know, Frazier and Cabrera aren't that valuable on the trade market anymore. And then Tommy Canley, I guess, seemed like he was pretty valuable, but, you know, doesn't exactly have the track record of success where, you know, we really had no idea what his trade value was going to be like. But from what it sounds like, the addition of Canley is kind of what put the deal over the top to be able to get someone like Rutherford. Because, you know, it would make sense to say, okay, you know, Frazier fetches kind of a low-end starting pitching prospect like Clarkin, who's dealt with injury problems but is a former first-round pick, kind of a lotto ticket type deal. And, you know, Tito Polo projects, from everything I've read, is more of like a fourth outfielder type. But packaging those two together with Canley seemed to be what put them over the top to get Rutherford, who some scouts are high on and some scouts aren't, but at the very least is another guy who could be something.
Yeah, it's cool that they were able to grab one more, to wring another potential impact prospect out of these pieces that they had. Obviously, like, if Canley's 2017 is for real, then yeah, he's super valuable, especially, you know, being a cost-controlled guy who could throw 70 something elite innings for you in high leverage spots. But yeah, for sure, Rutherford's a guy where, from what I've read, you know, he was old. He was old as a high school student who, when he was drafted, which some people think is, you know, I've heard some people argue that that is a bad indicator. And he's hitting for contact. He's not hitting for a ton of power in the low A, I think, right now, is a 20-year-old. So, you know, part of me kind of likes that Rutherford's safest tool seems to be bat-to-ball ability. It sort of diversifies, again, like, further diversifies their portfolio of guys. And if his power does take a step forward at any point as he ages into, you know, age 22, 23 over the next few years, you might have, even if he just turns into a, you know, a solid corner outfielder. I mean, if he starts putting up years like, I don't know, like Melky Cabrera with slightly better defense for the league minimum, as opposed to paying Melky $12, $13, $14 million a year to do that. I mean, that isn't a bad thing to have kicking around in your system. And if you're the White Sox and you're pretty confident that you can generate relievers and find them off the scrap heap, and they've demonstrated an ability to do that, then maybe you're not, and given, you know, if all of their pitching prospects bust, and then they've got a ton of relievers that way too, Canley isn't something that you need to hang on to. You had the luxury, like we talked about before, where you have control of him for a few years, where if you didn't get an offer that you liked, you could afford to pass and just hang on to him. And Robertson too, you could have held on to as well, but I like that they were able to make, you know, like you said, Clarkin's a good example of the type of prospect you probably could have expected, maybe a little better for just Robertson, where Clarkin, I know people used to, the Yankees writers used to love Clarkin before he had a couple of pretty bad arm injuries, and I don't think his stuff is where it used to be. But he's a lefty who still can, I think, sit in the low 90s and is supposed to have, I think, a good curveball.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the White Sox have a good track record of keeping guys healthy and low velocity pitchers from the left side. So, you know, maybe it's something that the dev team was optimistic about on Clarkin too. So there could be, you know, a couple of complementary pieces on the major league team coming from this deal. And Rutherford still has the potential to be a little more than that. He could still be a plus corner bat, but you're right. I mean, look at, I think the JD Martinez trade is kind of illustrative of what you might've expected from Frazier. I mean, Frazier is more defensive. He's a better defender at a more valuable position than JD Martinez. JD Martinez is a much, much better hitter, and they're both free agents after this season. The Diamondbacks traded for JD Martinez and gave up. I don't think any of those guys is really, they went for volume. They got three or four sort of lotto tickety guys. And I don't think they're very highly regarded. So for perspective, I mean, at this point, it's, do you foresee any further moves coming this year? I mean, it's only July 21st. There's still 10 more days before the trade deadline.
Yeah, I mean, I guess first going back to the deal itself, it's kind of funny. You know, obviously we weren't going to see the type of return that they've gotten in deals for kind of their more premier trade chips like Quintana. But the thing that's kind of funny about this deal to me is that while this return has the least likelihood of producing some sort of star and real big impact talent on the next roster. It's also the deal that has the least likelihood of looking bad in a few years. Because, you know, you can envision a world where everyone the White Sox got for Quintana busts. You know, I don't think that likelihood is very high for someone like Eloy Jimenez. But it's a possibility that they look back and Jose Quintana is still dominant and awesome 4 years from now, and none of those prospects are doing what the White Sox hoped. Even if that's the case with this Yankees deal, you know, Todd Frazier's on the back end of his career, and he might not even be a Yankee in 3 months. And David Robertson's on the back end of his career, and Tommy Canley is who the hell knows. So even if the return doesn't end up that great, this isn't the type of deal that has much of a likelihood of you look back at it and say, man, you know, the White Sox really got screwed in that deal.
Yeah, that's a really good point in terms of perspective. Like, whatever these guys do is kind of a bonus as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. To your last point, you know, the return, my first reaction to that J.D. Martinez return was, man, the White Sox are going to have to fucking give away Melky Cabrera, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, J.D. Martinez is, you know, one of the top corner outfielders in baseball this year and has been for the past 2-3 years. And he, like you said, the return was very underwhelming. I think the first guy that they got in return, you know, the Diamondback system is kind of trash to begin with. I don't think they had a single guy in the preseason top 101. I
think was Banda not in the top 101?
Banda is their top prospect, and he might have been. I'm trying to fill time.
No, you're right. He was in Baseball America top 100. He was not BP 101. No,
yeah,
right.
So, I mean, he's kind of a fringy top 100 guy. And so when I saw that deal and I was looking at Arizona's system, I go, well, you know, at least from a Tigers perspective, I have a lot of Tiger fan friends. I go, at least
I prefer having Tiger friends.
But I go, well, at least they're going to get, you know, another decent starting pitcher back. I assumed Banda was going to be a part of the deal, and then they didn't get him. And I think, you know, the top prospect they got in that deal, I think, was Doel Lugo.
Sounds right.
I'm probably saying that name wrong. But I know he's kind of probably, you know, maybe in the top 150 to 200 range as far as prospects go. But the fact that someone as good of a hitter as J.D. Martinez, even as a rental, didn't fetch, you know, real impact talent kind of surprised me a little bit. And I guess it speaks to what that market is like for hitters and outfielders more specifically. And the fact that Cabrera is older and not as good and also a rental, I'm like, I'm to the point where I'm kind of thinking he's going to be, you know, an August waiver deal.
Yeah. You know, and Ryan wrote a piece today that gives hope for that. You know, it's worth following. The White Sox did one of those deals with Gordon Beckham when he was clearly bad, I think to the Angels, I want to say. And they got Yency Almonte and turned Yency Almonte to Canley. And then Canley kind of got turned into Rutherford. And so that's a fun read up on BP's outside right now. And so, you know, maybe you get lucky.
Hey, they got Leury in an August waiver deal.
Yeah, was that a waiver deal?
I'm almost positive it was.
That was a year and a half of Rios. So, you know, prior to this year, that was pretty embarrassing trade.
Yeah.
But it was a salary dump, I guess. But, yeah, I don't see much value for Melky. I don't know who. Unless somebody gets hurt, we've talked about sort of, you need a buyer. It's not just like, what is this guy worth in a vacuum? I mean, you know, maybe the Mariners want him just because they're trading for any sort of safe thing they can get their hands on. But I don't think they need outfielders at this point. I mean, I don't know who's even sitting around the periphery of the playoff race who would be needing Melky's services.
Yeah, even like, I mean, you're talking like some of the more fringe contenders, like
maybe the Indians.
Yeah, I mean, their right field situation has kind of been a problem this year. I guess they've been, I think I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. Someone's going to listen and say I'm an idiot. I feel like it's been like Tyler Naquin and like Brandon Guyer out there, and Naquin hasn't been nearly as good as he was during his rookie year.
Chisholm's on the DL again.
Yeah, I'm only remembering this because I played the Indians in the trade games that are going up in on Baseball Prospectus this week, trying to put a deal together as the Indians for one of the Mets, Bruce, Granderson, Duda trio. So people can look out for that. The Indians, and I mean,
maybe the Royals.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, Max.
And there was a trade. What was it? There was a roundtable up on the main site today as well. I'll just keep plugging other articles that a bunch of really good BP writers were discussing what the Royals should do. Should they buy or sell? And what would that even look like? I'm of the opinion that I think they should buy, just because their next few years are going to be pretty miserable anyway. And they're in it. They have a non-zero chance of making it into the playoffs. And the guys that they would trade away, I don't see them really. We were just talking about Frazier and Melky not really being super great trade chips. I mean, who's giving up a ton for Mike Moustakas at this point? Like maybe the Red Sox, maybe. Yeah. And I don't, like, what is Hosmer going to bring back? Like an okay first baseman is going to bring back. He's not going to bring back more than JD Martinez, I wouldn't think, unless you've got some team out there that's being run the same way as the World Baseball Classic team was, where Hosmer's apparently better than Paul Goldschmidt. I don't know who. Maybe Lorenzo Cain gets you something decent, but if you're getting these like B-level prospects, is that really worth more than the, I don't know, I'd have to look at the playoff odds, but off the top of my head, the what, 10 to 15% chance you could have of making the playoffs? The Royals have so many dead spots on their roster. You know, they really haven't gotten anything out of DH. You know, we're talking like sub 600 OPS at DH. Alex Gordon is still looking pretty thoroughly dead. Yeah. They don't really have any bats to call up from the minors. I mean, if I were KC and I were actually trying to come in, they've had Melky before. I think the org left on good terms. I don't think the organization, you know, it's not like San Francisco where they wouldn't really want him back. That might be a fit. You're probably getting like a potential reliever for him, but that's better than nothing potentially. Otherwise, yeah. You know, Melky's just kind of fun to watch. So.
Exactly. My thought on the Royals is pretty much the same as what you said. It's almost like their farm system isn't anything special right now either. So
no.
Them attempting to try one more time with this core before they all leave in free agency isn't going to prolong their, I guess, rebuild after this year any longer. Like, so right. you're looking at the Royals from the perspective of, okay, after this year, shit's going to get terrible for them. Like, all of the players who helped them win the World Series are going to be gone, or most of them are going to be gone. And we don't have anyone in the pipeline ready to take their place. So if that's the case, trading those guys isn't going to flip that script to say, oh, actually, in 2018, we're going to be awesome. So why not give it a shot, knowing that it's going to take long, regardless of what happens in these last 3 months? But yeah, I mean, as a Melky landing spot, sure. But it's just, I mean, we said it after the Quintana deal that this is going to be probably the last big chip, and then they made another kind of surprising deal that got them a decent prospect in Rutherford, and now we're saying, well, that's definitely the last impact move the White Sox are going to make. So it's Melky, you know. I think it was
I think Swarzak, somebody would want him. I mean, he's super cheap. He's going to be a free agent at the end of the year. There's still – even like the Nationals still need relievers, I think, even with Madsen and Doolittle. And, you know, Doolittle and Madsen both aren't the most durable guys, as much as, you know, I really am a big fan of both of those pitchers. I guess if you're the White Sox, you know, he's probably – Swarzak's not going to bring back anything fancy. And maybe you're better off just having him around as one of, you know, like Clippard, where he's a competent major leaguer who can give cover for, you know, make sure your young guys don't have to wear one ever just to get through a game. Make sure your position players don't have to pitch. So
yeah,
you can go either way there. I guess Jose Abreu is another interesting consideration.
Although it doesn't sound like they're – maybe this is just reports, but it doesn't sound like the White Sox want to move him. I think it was Heyman who reported. I'm trying to bring up his article from yesterday, his little around-the-league notes package, and he just has one snippet here. There is no Jose Abreu trade on the horizon. But they do mention that, I mean, this is probably just wishful thinking at this point, but it does sound like they're trying to, or hoping at least to unload Derek Holland still. Not that he's going to get anything, even if they're able to move him, because he's been so terrible since the beginning of June, basically, at this point.
I mean, if you thought, if you had asked me in May, I would have said that Miguel Gonzalez and Derek Holland both look like guys who would be worth something to someone. I mean, Jaime Garcia is a guy who's being bid for as we speak. I think it's rumors either the Twins or the Dodgers might be interested just to have a, you know, warm body in the rotation. And unfortunately, Holland's been throwing batting practice for a month and a half now, and Gonzalez is working his way back up through rehab start. Or did he make his first start? I think he pitched.
Yeah, he started against Clayton Kershaw, and they only lost 1-0.
Right, he pitched pretty well, I guess.
Yeah, so. He walked like 5 guys, I think. But
you know, I mean, if he can show he's healthy, he might be a waiver deal. But those guys again might be more valuable to you just to give you innings at this point than they would in a trade. So Abreu. You know, James Fegan just wrote a piece about Abreu's relationship as a mentor with Moncada, and with Moncada up, especially now. I mean, maybe you still want to keep Abreu for that purpose as well.
Yeah, beyond the fact that picked him up in the
airport. Yeah, exactly. Keep him as a chauffeur. But Abreu's still got, it's either 2 or 3 years left after this one, I want to say. So, yeah, he's signed through 2019. So I guess you'd have opportunities to maybe trade him as a rental at that point if your team doesn't arrive in 2019 like you might hope. But again, the corner, the first baseman, you know, bat only type guys, you're probably not going to get an offer that makes you want to part with him.
Yeah, because like I think we talked about on last podcast, the value that he provides just kind of as being there for some of these young guys coming up, particularly Moncada, probably outweighs anything you're going to get in a return for him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the Yankees still want a first baseman. I mean,
yeah, I guess their talk. I mean, and if they, as far as the first base market goes, it sounds like they've got theirs. And maybe it's because Jose Abreu hasn't really been made available to much of an extent, but it sounds like they, from all the reports I read, is that they might be doing another package deal where they'd get like Sonny Gray and Yonder Alonso, you know, from the Athletics.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
That would make sense to me. If they're going to contend, and they certainly still have plenty more, they have a very deep system. So I wouldn't be worried about that if I were a Yankee fan. Okay. So most of the trade deadline fireworks, unless something really weird happens, look like they've gone off, which is an interesting situation to be in on July 21st. I mean, at this point, you'd be adding long shots, lotto tickets, low floor guys, low ceiling guys from here on out, I would think, unless something really weird happened.
I would think so.
Now I'm really interested in the Royals. Jeez, I mean, do you think that they let all three of those big guys walk this offseason? I mean, they did bump their payroll up into the top third in connection with their run of success. I think that they might be able to bring back one of those guys.
So when you're saying all three, are you including the worst hitter in baseball, Cetus Escobar, or are you not including him at all? So Moustakas, Hosmer, and Kane.
Correct. Yeah. I
feel like Kane would be the one you'd want to bring back the most, but he's probably also the most expensive. If I had to guess, I bet they bring back Hosmer just because I think Hosmer's not going to get nearly – I think Hosmer is a Boris client, if I'm not mistaken, and it's going to be one of those things where he's going to, his asking price is going to be so insane that he's going to be sitting out there on the free agent market forever and then realize that no one's going to pay him like Paul Goldschmidt, and then he's going to come back on a really cheap deal. That's just my guess.
Yeah, I mean, he's younger than Edwin Encarnacion. Encarnacion hit the free agent market, and like I said, some people are just weird about how they think about Hosmer, where they think he's this elite guy when really he's hitting really well this year. But for his career, he's a guy who, he's a 773 OPS as a first baseman. Like, that's fine.
Yeah. Like, I'm trying to think of even like a historical comp of just kind of that average. Is he like Mark Grace or something? I don't know.
I don't even think he's as good as Mark Grace.
Yeah.
No, Grace was a better hitter. That's going to be really interesting because you only need one team to go crazy and overpay for him. And who knows, maybe this year in his age 27 season, Hosmer's figured something out. He's realized that like grounding to second is not like an elite offensive strategy, but that is going to be something worth watching. I'm talking myself into like Melky to maybe Melky and Swarzak to get at the Royals for some of their mediocrities in the minors.
You know, you've been really civil about the Royals. We've talked about them a lot, and you're being way more civil than I'm used to. I know you don't like to swear on podcasts or on Twitter. I mean, you just feel like you need to drop like a fuck the Royals or something. You know, this podcast is not for speaking logically about the Royals. We hate the Royals on this podcast, and we want them to fail miserably at everything they do.
It's true.
So.
It's true. I'd like – the thing is, gosh – you know, you don't want to, you want all of your division rivals to fail.
Yes.
It would be kind of funny if Cleveland didn't win the division, but the teams that are positioned to take advantage of that would also upset me. You know, there's no real, one of the Twins, Royals, and Indians is going to win that division, and that makes me sad. If the Indians do, you'll get the least crowing from people about a team that got really lucky. Which is probably the best outcome for me in terms of my own rage. And I think if the Royals edge out the Twins, I don't think there's going to be any new hagiography about the Royals that hasn't already been irresponsibly and partially responsibly like thrown around yet. So, you know, I think if the Royals get in, that would be less upsetting than if the Twins do. Just because of context.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know.
Because the Twins are just bad.
Yeah, the Twins are just bad. It's just, I guess from my perspective, it's more just like we've seen it all before with the Royals. Like I'm tired of it, and it's like the Twins. At least it's like, oh, cool, we get to watch Miguel Sano in the playoffs on a national stage. I don't know. And then with the Royals, it's like, you know, screw all these players. I've seen them all, and I hate them all, and I want to go on to the next thing. You know?
Yeah, if they miss the playoffs, it probably, you know, it ties a bow on that era where they squeaked into the wild card one year and obviously made a great run to the World Series, and then they won the World Series, and that would be pretty much it for after a 10 – I mean, you'd go back like 20-something year rebuilding cycle, but for the Dayton Moore administration, it took him – took him eight years, I think, to get there, and I don't know. I think Moore deserves a lot of credit for having built the World Series winner and building the team in the way that he did. It was really neat, and every World Series winner is lucky, but I think we need to pump the brakes a little bit on how we rate that front office just a little bit.
Did you know that Lorenzo Cain's nickname is Crunch Wrap?
No.
Baseball That's Reference treats me teaches me the weirdest shit. Nicknames Crunch Wrap or Locaine.
Crunch Wrap is so much better than Locaine. Locaine's boring.
But I'll look it up later. I want to know the backstory of Crunch Wrap. It's actually interesting, kind of, I know we're going off on a little bit of a side tangent here, but talking about, I guess, the AL Central teams and how we want them all to fail, I'd be curious what you and what other people think of the proposition I made with my Tigers fan buddy, where we essentially just made a long-term bet of who makes the playoffs first, the Tigers or the White Sox. What do you think about that?
I mean, at this point, you'd have to say the White Sox, right?
You would think so, yeah. Right?
I don't know what is going to emerge for the Tigers' spending habits now that Mike Ilitch has passed away. They do still have, you know, I don't know if they get somebody to bite on if they can trade Verlander or Kinsler or Miguel Cabrera, if they have any interest in doing that. I mean, it could just be a down year, but Miguel Cabrera's OPS is 784 at the moment, and he's owed something like $25 million a year until 2023 or something like that, with vesting options after. It's really insane. That was what was kind of funny about the Verlander trade rumors at first. It's like, well, the Tigers might be willing to trade Justin Verlander. It's like, he costs like $30 million a year, and he's like below average pitcher this year. So, yeah, I'd imagine you'd be consider trading someone like that. Obviously, getting Michael Fulmer for a rental was a really nice little move. Daniel Norris hasn't quite developed the way I thought he would. So no, I don't. And they don't have anything in the system.
They've got no. It's like and all the guys, even like the guys who some people are high on, are really far away. Like Matt Manning, you know.
Yeah.
Some people really like Matt Manning and think he could be a front end starter, but he's like 19 still or something, and pitching in low A. And you know, Alex Fado, their first round pick this year, and then they've got just a bunch of hard throwing relievers like Bo Burrows, and they've got Kyle Funkhauser, who might be a starter.
I like Funkhauser. Yeah. I thought that was a good value pick where they got him,
but it's just a bunch of really volatile arms are like the top guys in their system.
Yeah, they don't have enough at the major league roster that's still going to be good in the next few years that offsets the chasm between the White Sox current system and the Tigers current system.
It's a really big bummer for them, I think, that they weren't able to get more for JD, because he was the one really valuable trade chip they had. Even though he was a rental, he was young, and he was still hitting like you would project. Like, even Kinsler, I was just looking at him, like, if the Tigers had known they were going to be in this situation in the offseason, which I think Alavila hinted at, like, you know, we'd be willing to sell, you know, Kinsler would have probably been a pretty good trade chip last winter, because he was coming off of, like, his, I don't know, 10th consecutive year of being an above average hitter at a second base and also one of the better defenders at that position. And now he's, you know, a free agent after this season. I guess there's a team option on him, and he's, you know, his OPS has dropped from 831 last year to 726 this year. His OPS plus dropped from 124 last year to 94 this year. you know, he's still, and he's 35, you know, so
exactly.
It's like, I think that trading someone like Verlander or even someone like Miguel Cabrera is always kind of a pipe dream, although, you know, I guess it's certainly possible, but like the few guys they had, that's why there are people who, you know, people who I like and respect who are saying that they should trade Michael Fulmer, which seems insane because he's young and he's awesome. But it's like, if the market for starting pitchers is the way it is, I don't know if I would necessarily agree that you need to trade him, but like I can sort of see the logic there, where it's like, you know, this is going to take a long time to kind of put back together. And as young as Fulmer is, like, let's cash in and kind of push our window back even further in hopes that, you know, he can bring us back something that's have a wider depth, I guess.
Yeah, I guess the argument for your friend winning that bet would be if you count on if the Tigers sign some free agents this offseason and you count on saying, okay, you know, we've seen Verlander be bad and bounce back before. Maybe Miguel Cabrera is playing hurt. Maybe he's still got – I mean, guys of that caliber tend to have more – sort of late 30s bounce back years than guys of a lesser quality. I mean, hell, look at Victor Martinez. Maybe those guys bounce back. Maybe Kinsler gets a little luckier on balls in play and Castellanos takes a step forward. You know, and maybe we can get lucky and push in for the playoffs like one more time in 2018 before you start tearing things down. I mean, the danger, you're right though. I mean, it could be that Fulmer doesn't align with the rest of their franchise's competitive abilities, but you know, I've seen people joke about it where, like, I think you joked about it, like, Moncada's in the majors, it's better trade him for prospects.
Yeah.
you know, all the most the reasons why somebody's really valuable in a trade are the same reasons why you might want to build around them. It's because there's multiple years of control and a really good player. So
Falmer blows my mind too, because he doesn't strike anyone out, and he has, I think I saw a stat a week or two ago about, like, among qualified pitchers, the average velocity on his fastball is like the third fastest. And he strikes out 6.3 batters per nine.
Yeah, that's kind of nuts.
Yeah, he has 89 strikeouts in 126 innings this year, but he throws like 95 regularly.
Yeah, I think his average fastball is like 96 or something like that when I looked at Brooks. I mean, he throws really hard. His ground ball percentage isn't that nuts either. I mean, it's just under 50%. I mean, that's good, but it's not, you know, it's not like the Brandon Webb, Felix Halliday of old caliber. So,
yeah,
you know, it could be, if you say this is a ground ball pitcher who throws really hard. My dad always floated the theory that those guys don't age well. And I guess he was citing, like, I think some examples he threw out there were like Chim and Wong. Like, you know, he had some injuries. Fausto Carmona didn't age well. Those are some recent examples of those types of guys.
Roberto Hernandez, you mean?
Oh, no way. Fausto Carmona's – Roberto Hernandez was the White Sox closer in the 90s.
Yeah, but Fausto Carmona was actually Roberto Hernandez.
Yeah, no, he wasn't, though.
What?
I'm opting out of reality.
Oh. Okay.
There's no way you can convince me to call a guy whose name – if I'm choosing between Fausto Carmona and Roberto Hernandez to refer to some guy, like, that's not even a choice.
All right.
That's easy. So we're about half an hour in. Moncada's up.
We haven't talked Moncada, yeah.
He's only had 3 plate appearances, right?
Yeah, and he sucks. He has a 0.000 batting average, so I'm kind of concerned. I don't know where your level of concern is, but
yeah,
I think the rebuild's a failure.
Yeah. No, it was cool watching him take – it was cool watching him take close pitches. It was cool watching him work a walk after falling behind 0-2 to a very – you know, Maeda is a guy who is extremely crafty, you know, to an extent that, you know, I don't think there are a ton of – maybe AAA is a little bit like this, but, you know, to be able to work a walk like that was a triumph, I would say. So – and he had that the foul ball heard around the world. So,
I mean, props to former kind of contributor Matt Provenzano for making that post that kind of – I saw linked to multiple different articles of the crowd reaction, and I guess it kind of showed his swing mechanics in slow motion of that foul ball heard around the world. I like the way you put that.
Yeah, I mean, he's – so we're looking at, I guess, Anderson Moncada up the middle for the foreseeable future. Third base is going to be a revolving door of Davidson, Saladino. I guess Yolmer's going to – spell Anderson and Moncada from time to time, and I don't know, if I guess DH him a little bit too.
I mean, he can play third too.
Yeah, so those three guys are going to be bouncing around. Saladino might get some time in the outfield. I mean, part of you may be willing to trade Melky just to free up some more plate appearances for some more of these guys.
Exactly.
But I don't really have a ton. I mean, Moncada, I don't have a ton to add other than I think what's interesting, I saw somebody refer to him as having strike zone judgment issues. I don't think that's the case. I think he reads the ball fine. I think it's just literally just swing and miss issues. I think he just swings really hard, as Jeff Paternoster said, and he's trying to get into his power. And
yeah,
I mean, we saw him take close pitches.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see once there's, I guess, some more data on him now that he's in the majors about like his zone percentages and his swing percentages inside the zone versus outside the zone. But I'm with you. And that's kind of what Jeff said, is that it's not so much that he swings at everything. It's that he often just swings and misses because he swings so hard. But I guess just going back to his debut, you know, it's really easy to kind of the whole pageantry of it almost is something that, that gets overblown, and it's understandable because it's really exciting. I think I saw a thing that, you know, that Wednesday's game had the highest rating of the year for Comcast Sportsnet, which I'm sure isn't saying much, but it just shows, you know, everyone was really excited to watch Moncada play. And while we can dissect, you know, how he looked as much as we can and as much as I did and others did the day after in articles, you know, it's you got to kind of keep things in perspective with him and say, you know, the fact that he's here is really exciting. And the fact that he's kind of, as I know Rick Hahn has put it at times, kind of reached that next step in his development is really important. But, like, we can't have ourselves, like, overreacting to every strikeout or every hit or every home run, because it's just, you know, what his, I think the way I put it in my article Wednesday was that the process is more important than the results. And that sounds kind of cliche, but it's like, if he goes 0-2, like he did on Wednesday, you know, again on Friday, then that's fine, because he doesn't look overmatched at the plate like he did, you know, in his abbreviated stint with Boston last year. He looks like he knows what the hell he's doing. Both of the balls he put in play were scorched, you know. So it's like whatever the results end up being, whatever his numbers end up being for these final 2.5 months aren't that important. It's that he looks like he's able to handle major league pitching and kind of has progressed to the point where you're even more confident than you were before that he's going to be as good as advertised and a legit next piece of a White Sox winner.
So you'll be tracking his launch angle.
Oh, absolutely. And his his exit velocity and his launch angle. I mean, if he can go, you know, 106 off the bat and 12 degree launch angle every at bat, then that's what we're looking for. And I you know, I'm sure the coaches are working with him on it, saying, you know, if you just hit the ball, you know, 12 degrees and they get out a protractor and no.
And if he can, you know, his defense is going to be something to keep an eye on too at second, because that'll help shore up his floor. I mean, if this is a guy who hits, if he's more of a 240 guy, and he's a burner, so I feel like even with a high strikeout rate, he's going to have a decent batting average. But
yeah,
you know, those are the types of things to keep an eye on. Definitely, like you said, it's a process thing more than, especially because even playing every day for the rest of the season, it's not going to be the biggest sample size in the world, even as a guy who's adjusting, making the biggest adjustment he can, which is from the minors to the majors. But it is, I think, having 300-something plate appearances at AAA compared to last year's and not having to do a position change in a pennant race is really going to should be a better situation for him to succeed. And, you know, obviously, hopefully he hits like 380 with power the rest of the season. That'd be fun, too. But in terms of other potential promotions, you know, Moncada's the first and the most heralded. I know that I want to talk about Giolito later in tandem with another talking point that I was sent in. But Ronaldo Lopez has been on a good little run in AAA.
Yes.
I think some scouts have you know, non-White Sox scouts have said, yeah, he looks like he's ready to at least make the leap and finish his development in the majors. Do you think he's the next guy we'll see?
I feel like he is.
He just struck out 12 over 7 innings, allowing one run on his last start. He should be pitching again tonight, I would think.
Yeah, and it does kind of get to the point, and, you know, shout out to James. Right? Referencing his work a lot today, as we usually do, which is definitely worth checking out at theathletic.com. But he had a quote from a scout in his write-up of Lopez on Tuesday where he said, oh, league scout, he's an advanced arm. Good to get him exposure now, said a league scout. He is shredding. It's time, kids. You know, that's one league scout, but it's kind of the way I see it, especially now that we're kind of past this trade season to a certain extent. And it's just, I don't know. Maybe from a fan standpoint, you obviously want to see it because what the hell else is worth watching the rest of the season? You know, you can only handle so many Mike Pelfrey outings before you lose your sanity. But I mean, from a developmental standpoint, like, I don't care that much that the White Sox aren't calling him up because they know better than I do, and they know better than any damn Twitter scout knows.
Right.
But it seems like he's ready. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a scout, but I feel like it's time to see what he's got up there.
Yeah, and obviously we've talked about this with Craig, and there's more to getting promoted than just having some pretty stats.
Yeah.
But, you know, just he is at the point where, you know, he had some success in the major leagues last year. You know, it was in September.
Yeah.
And then you have his last four starts in AAA, he's thrown 25 and two-thirds innings. He has 33 strikeouts against only five walks, five runs. You know, he's really, like, dominated the last four times in a row out there. Whether they're seeing him holding his mechanics as much as they'd like, I don't know. But that – I mean, his stuff is certainly major league caliber. And if he's not walking guys and he's not giving up home runs, I don't know. I'd be pretty confident in him being able to at least hold his own in the majors. I guess one of the – you know, I don't know what sort of – how many innings they want him to throw this year. But, you know, if you're on a really good run like that, maybe it's – you know, it'd be good to reward a guy and say, hey, you know, this is – you know, you've been doing what we've asked and you've been getting good results. So, you know – have at it. Quintana's spot, obviously, you know, we have Miguel Gonzalez came back as Quintana left. So maybe they would say we don't have room for him in the rotation, but it's hard to imagine that he couldn't outperform, you know, Pelfrey or I mean, maybe they give it another 10 days just to see hope against hope if Holland or Gonzalez can get anything on the market. You know, maybe Holland strings together two good starts and somebody bites for anything at all. Or Miguel Gonzalez shows, hey, you know, he was getting hit around. That's because he wasn't healthy. He's healthy again. He's a back end starter. Maybe somebody desperate grabs him for a song.
Yeah.
I think that's the only reason. Those are the only possible reasons why Lopez wouldn't get called up.
Yeah. And I think that you obviously still want to showcase Gonzalez and Holland as much as possible, just in the outside chance that, as slim as it may be, the outside chance that you can fetch something for him. You know, Pelfrey's not in that category. Pelfrey's the kind of guy who, when you're done with him, you throw him in a trash can on the side of the road. Yeah. But
that's not what Colin Witcher's bot says.
did he tweet something about Pelfrey lately or?
Oh no, it was the big pelf madness.
But
baby driver for some reason.
I think the thing that makes me most interested in seeing what Lopez can do at the major league level is just because there's such drastically different opinions among evaluators about what he is. You know, some people say, you know, he's definitely a starter, or as definitely as an evaluator can say that, you know, top 40, top 50 type guy. And some people, you know, are saying, you know, he's definitely a reliever, not in my top 100, et cetera. So the fact that, I mean, like you said with Moncada, 2.5 months isn't a very big sample size, but I think that as much time as he spends in the majors this year, we're going to go into the off season with a better idea, the White Sox with a better idea also, more importantly, of if he is a starter going forward.
Yeah. And it'd be nice to see him against non-September rosters, potentially.
For sure.
Although that's sort of a secondary – that's a really secondary or tertiary concern. But, yeah, I mean, other than that, you know, Carson Fulmer seems to have taken a pretty severe step back. I think Giolito is someone we should address, and I kind of want to pair this. Circling back to the first thing, we had a reader submit, refer me to the New York Post from yesterday, a Joel Sherman article, where some front office personnel were contacted, and it says one element that came up was the lack of universal love for Blake Rutherford, Not one executive spoken to felt he had the tools to remain in center. Many wondered if he'd develop enough power long-term to justify a corner spot. One NL executive likened this to the White Sox getting Lucas Giolito, saying the Nationals had internally soured on Giolito and wanted to trade him before the whole sport caught on. I sense the Yankees traded Rutherford at the top of his market when the buzz was still good. So I want to react to that in terms of Rutherford. I don't think that really – actually, in terms of Rutherford and Giolito, I don't think the White Sox were, like, late to the game on these guys. I don't think the White Sox – like, I don't think the Eaton package, given that Lopez and Dunning are both also really good, the White Sox traded Eaton for, like, that, it's post number one overall, whatever prospect, Giolito status is reflected in that trade. I don't think the White Sox were, like, didn't realize his velocity had gone down or didn't realize he walked more guys than he struck out in the majors. Like, I don't really, if people act like, I've kind of been past that since the trade. Like, I don't think Giolito's 100-mile-an-hour fastball is ever coming back. Yeah. I don't think of him as a potential ace anymore. But we saw Jeff Long's write-up recently on the site, who caught him, granted, on one of his really good starts, two starts ago. I mean, Giolito's last five starts, he's had two phenomenal ones, two abysmal ones, and one okay one. And that's kind of emblematic of the year, where they're working through his... they're overhauling his mechanics. They're trying to fix the damage the Nationals did to him and get him to a place where by the end of this year, he looks like he could be a mid-rotation starter, not like an ace. But if you got a mid-rotation starter for him, let's say we go pessimistic on all these guys. Let's say you got a fourth starter in Giolito, you got a closer in Ronaldo Lopez, and you got another fourth starter in Dane Dunning.
That's still a pretty damn good return for Adam Eaton.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. And that's not even considering the fact that they all have the potential to do more, which you also traded for. You traded for that range of outcomes, right? So yes. I don't know. I don't think that that's really a great comparison. And like you said about what the White Sox gave up for Rutherford, you know, Frazier's a nice little rental. Robertson's a solid reliever. Kainley could be a monster for a few years. Maybe not. I don't think that the White Sox, like, were late to the game on Rutherford either. I think most of the industry is where those scouting reports are. I don't think anybody really thought Rutherford was going to be a center fielder when he was drafted. Maybe people are less confident on his power developing than they were a year ago. But if he's a second division starter in a corner outfield spot, I don't know. That's even that is not the worst, like, return for these guys. So I don't think either of those comparisons is really apt.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing, and I guess I'm kind of reiterating what I said earlier in the podcast a little bit, but the thing about Rutherford that I keep going back on is, you know, we refer often to kind of the back-end prospect throw-ins for deals like this as lotto tickets, you know, and to a certain extent, every prospect is a lotto ticket, you know.
Yeah,
it's just that some of them are lotto tickets. Some of them are bets you're making that have a little bit better odds. And the thing about Rutherford is nothing the White Sox gave up had a chance of being, and Kainley may be the closest to it, of being a legit contributor on the next White Sox contender. Frazier for sure no, Robertson for sure no, Kainley maybe, and that's a reliever. Rutherford has a better chance at being a contributor on the next White Sox winner. He has a better chance at being a contributor on the next White Sox winner than any of the players that they gave up for him. And maybe that chance is 5%. Maybe it's 30%. Maybe it's 60%. But it's still more than any of the other guys. And he's a lotto ticket. He's a lotto ticket who has a better odds than Ian Clarkin, than Tito Polo, whose name I just love saying.
Yeah, and you could have seen Tito Polo. If you watched Quintana's team pitching in the World Baseball Classic, I believe Tito Polo was a teammate of his on there.
Yeah, he played center field against the U.S., I believe.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That sounds right. Yeah.
People love Rutherford. People hate Rutherford. People are in between about Rutherford. But, you know, 3 days ago, if you'd have said there's a guy who's got a chance to be a contributor on the next White Sox winner and they're going to acquire him and give up nothing of legitimate future value, I would have been like, fucking cool, man. So yeah. It's not so much about whether I like or dislike Rutherford, or whether certain evaluators or scouts like or dislike Rutherford. It's the fact that he has a chance, and I think that's good enough that I'm for the trade, you know, more than others might be.
And like I said, if his swing, the most recent thing I read on him is that he's a nice swing for contact, and you know, the way things are trending, I mean, home run rates, are we really going to, if you have one area where this guy might not excel is power. I mean, who's to say as he turns, I mean, I'm not just trying to equate, you know, hand wave away power, which is like a massively important tool, but there were people who thought he had it in him, and there's, you know, you got random post-bust prospects, like middle infield prospects busting out 30 home run seasons in the majors now. Like, I don't know. I mean, are we really – he's still a top 100 guy. You know, like that's – he's still a top 100 guy. He still looks like he'd be a pretty good corner outfielder defensively.
And he's been in a major league organization for 13 months.
Yeah.
You know, he's got 439 career minor league plate appearances to his name, and people are making these sweeping conclusions about what he's going to become. I know he's a little on the older side, but it's kind of crazy, you know. I think it was in the transactions analysis, I think Greg Goldstein wrote that unlike most high school prospects, he's considered a
pretty safe guy.
High floor, low ceiling. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's cool, you know. I feel like I'm becoming like a cheerleader for Rutherford and a cheerleader for this deal, but I mean, I just didn't think the White Sox were going to get any more impact talent, and they got one who might be.
The only way it was a bad deal is if they had a better offer from somewhere else.
Yeah,
which
there's no way we would ever know that.
Yeah.
I know. We kind of got off topic here. You brought up that article more to pinpoint on the Giolito reference than the Rutherford.
Oh, I mean, I said what I wanted to say about it. I don't know. I mean, Giolito throws 91 and 95 now. He's a pitchability guy. He's got good pitchability. Jeff Long loved his approach as a pitcher. So now it's just a matter of getting some reps in to get the White Sox the way they want his mechanics to be. And you know, he's still got a good curveball. I think he's added a slider. Still working on his changeup. I mean, he's not – I don't know. He's pretty close to ready. I'd expect we'd see him in September unless they think he's worked enough innings this year by that point. But, you know, he should be challenging for the rotation next spring, I would think.
Yeah, I feel like there's a certain level of the feelings about Giolito, at least, I mean, as a non-professional observer – it's probably a little different, and maybe even for the professional observers, where because of how highly regarded he was in the past, it makes, you know, number three starter potential kind of underwhelming and kind of a bummer. Whereas any pitching prospect becoming a number three starter in the major leagues is a good thing. You know, the probability of that happening for anyone is so low, given how most pitching prospects turn out. That's awesome. But I, you know, like Craig Goldstein was saying, you know, him being the only guy in their archives who had a OFP of 80, it seems pretty underwhelming right now. It's like you watching a movie that you see the trailer for and you say, well, that looks really shitty, and you see it and it's okay, and you're like, awesome, you know, that's like Alec Hansen, and then you see a trailer and you read a bunch of reviews and you're like, this movie looks fucking awesome, and then it just turns out okay and you're like, that movie sucked.
right Yeah, it's all expectations. Mm-hmm. And you know, like you said, he wasn't in the organization until after some of the, you know, number, you know, like ace Cy Young award challenging guy sort of expectations. And you know, I don't know, like Jameson Taillon went through that sort of arc as well. So I don't know.
He turned 23 a week ago. So I mean, he's not super young for a prospect, but he seems like a really smart guy. You know, I interviewed him in spring training, and I know that's kind of that's just kind of one person's observation based off of a interview where a camera's in his face, but he seems like a really really self-aware and really smart guy, and you know, there's maybe he is still figuring shit out. You know, he's still young, and
well, the Nationals did like altered his mechanics last year.
Yeah,
and these are, you know, it's the type of thing where you don't want to have to be thinking about your movements as an athlete. You want them to be automatic. So that takes time. It's going to take the White Sox were pretty upfront about this. It was going to take all year to get him to his natural mechanics. And that's why maybe we see him in September. Maybe we don't. And that still shouldn't change his ETA to be sometime in to be in the rotation at some point in 2018.
For sure.
And so, there's still reason to think he can be a plus starting pitcher. So,
yeah, I mean, and like you said, they got three of those guys for Adam Eaton. So, you know,
yep.
you talked about how if every one of those guys kind of hits their, you know, I don't want to say floor, but like.
Right. The floor for all these dudes is like the floor in like an absolute sense is that none of them are major leaguers at all.
Exactly. But like the realistic floor that the example you laid out. Like, if that were the case, then the trade would still be a success. If Lopez and Dunning turn out like they could and, like, hit, I don't, maybe not their ceiling, but, like, are above average starting pitchers, and Giolito flames out like some people are afraid he might do, then it's even still a good trade.
If you got, and maybe you got three number three starters out of it, which would be nuts.
Yeah, that would be, quite the deal. So we are at about the hour mark now. Do you want to get to some reader questions?
Yeah, we have three that I have. I don't know if any more came in beyond what
I
have.
I'm looking at the same thing you sent me. So
I may start with the bottom one because it seems to fit with what we're talking about right now. This comes from at Talking Sox. I don't think their name is White Sox in real life, but that is their name on here. Now that Moncada has graduated, which White Sox prospects do you think can take over that number one prospect spot in all of baseball?
So I kind of went back and forth with him a little bit last night because I was bored. And, you know, the obvious answer to that question is Eloy Jimenez because he is number two in the system. He was number eight on BP's midseason top 50. But it doesn't seem like that the time frame between him kind of graduating as a prospect doesn't really fall in line where you could see a reasonable expectation of him jumping some of the guys in front of him. You know, Craig talked about how he is the top-ranked player who doesn't play an elite defensive position, catcher, short, or center field. So you're looking at guys graduating sooner than expected who are ahead of him or kind of dropping off like J.P. Crawford-esque. So, I guess I don't know what you think, Nick. My thought, my inclination is almost that if there's anyone on this team who has a chance of being the quote unquote consensus number one prospect in baseball, my money would almost be on Michael Kopech before it was on Eloy Jimenez.
Interesting. I don't know if I go so far as to say before. There's a path where, you know, Kopech. I think Kopech had like a really good start his last time out. I think last night, but. Yeah, I mean, Kopech is that guy who has, you know, Alex Reyes was on our preseason number one, was our preseason number one right before he got Tommy John surgery at BP. I mean, Kopech has been a top 10 guy even before this year for Keith Law. You know, he's got that crazy, crazy arsenal and the really great build, and he just needs reps, and there's the question of his role and how many innings he can handle. But if you have the ceiling that he does, yeah, you can. He's in a position where he could put himself in the conversation. Outlets, I think, are getting more and more shy about putting a pitcher number one. I think Alex Reyes may be illustrative of why that's dangerous.
Yeah.
But, you know, these are the most innings Kopech's ever thrown. His ERA is 3.5 at AA as a 21-year-old who's really not thrown very much. You know, yeah, he's not like – that's. I totally see the path of where that would happen. I still think it's Eloy just based on the fact that he's already near there, and there was an argument for him at number one if you really liked him. I think apparently this, you know, even already, even before Moncada went up, some people like Aloy's bat a lot better than Moncada's. And some of that's just a matter of timing, right? Like, these lists come out at preseason and midseason.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it's kind of arbitrary, right? Because this is such a fluid thing.
It's like maybe he was the number one prospect on May 30th and nobody knew it because nobody did a list about it.
Yeah. And you look at the guys who are probably going to graduate in the interim. I don't know. He's right around the same timeline as guys like Victor Robles. He's right around the same timeline as – I think he's a little behind Brandon Rogers. He's kind of in the same cluster time-wise as, I don't know, Vlad Jr.
Yeah.
Kyle Tucker, probably a little bit ahead of him. So, you know, you're going to have a lot of graduations. And then you're going to have, you know, guys coming up behind him too. So it's cool that the White Sox have – other guys we could make credible paths to that. But it's, you know, am I going to bet on any of them accomplishing that? Probably not.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily matter. It's a fun question. It's fun to think about.
Exactly.
But you know, it doesn't change how I think about Eloy's potential outcome.
Exactly. You brought up how there's kind of some hesitation to rank pitchers that highly anymore. I did look back out of curiosity at before Alex Reyes this preseason, when the last time a starting pitcher was, or a pitcher, I guess, was number one on BP's preseason top 101, and it was Matt Moore in 2012 was number one, which was 5 years ago and seems like it was 20 years ago, given, you know,
yeah.
Matt Moore's career path. The other guy, and I don't want to stay on this subject for too long, but the other guy who's kind of got a shot at eventually raising to that number one status would be Robber, of course, you know, depending on, you know, given his youth and where he's at and where people think he could be, you know, if he just bursts onto the season and starts tearing it up, you could see him raise to top 10, top five level. You know,
that's a
little bit of wishful thinking, but that would be pretty sweet.
I mean, yeah, we're talking again. It's kind of like Kopech, right? Where obviously a little even further removed, but
yeah,
he's got that, you know, ceiling. Like, there's a path where that happens, because as opposed to like Spencer Adams, is never, there is no path. Even though he's had a great year at Double A for him, it's been after his star was kind of fading, and I think his stock's gone back up a bit this year, but that's a counter example.
Michael Kopech's middle name is Talbert.
Oh, Giolito's got him beat there by a lot.
What's Giolito's?
Frost
and Talbert. I mean, Frost is at least a word I've heard of in my life. Talbert? Am I crazy? I've never heard of the name Talbert before.
Like the running back?
Like, except with an A.
Oh, no. That's new.
Yeah.
Maybe it's
Frost. Where did Frost come from? I gotta ask him about that.
Yeah. Maybe that's where he gets his love of baking.
Yeah.
But, I guess just quickly, because we already an hour and 10, question comes from Kevin Shannon, who goes by Lucian Charms on Twitter, asking if Avi finishes strong, what's more likely, offseason trade, sign extension, or let 2018 be an prove it year?
The latter. That's my vote goes to the latter. I've written a couple times this season about how it's going to take a really, really long time for me to believe in Avi. And obviously I am rooting for him. And I think that, he's proved a lot of doubters wrong. He's proven me wrong to a certain extent, but I'm not ready to commit long-term money to him, but I also don't think it would make much sense to trade him. Given, you know, where his potential is based on what we've seen from him for 3 months this season.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly slumped really hard heading into the All-Star break. He was playing through some injuries. He's gone right back. He's at another three multi-hit games in the last week again. So,
yeah.
He's it's so hard. I mean, like you said, I was wrong on him too heading into this year. I had him as before they traded Sale and Eaton, and it wasn't clear whether they would necessarily try to win in 2017 or not. Once they cleared that out, it was like, okay, well, he's not blocking anybody. Even if there's a 5% chance there's a good major leaguer still in there, that's better than, you know, that's a worthwhile place to put your outfield plate appearances in 2017, given the rest of the roster. But other, you know, if they've been trying to contend, I had him as a non-tender candidate this year. So,
right.
You know, the White Sox have obviously been higher on him than pretty much everybody for like 5 years now. The idea of them giving up on him now seems hard to imagine. At the same time, you know, and that's why this is a good question. You know, he's a free agent after 2019. And we've talked about how rental bats don't seem to be super valuable, certainly corner bats. So if you're gonna, if he continues, you know, if he finishes the year with a pretty batting line that you think is a mirage and somebody makes you an offer you like, I think you should listen.
For sure.
But maybe it is the type of thing where, you know, he's 26. Maybe he's an average to slightly above average corner outfielder until he's 30, 31. And maybe you do want to see if he's willing to do one of those extensions that, because he hasn't, you know, this isn't a guy who's set for life or whatever. He hasn't had that big free agent contract or anything like that. So maybe you do meet him in the middle somewhere, and maybe an extension does make sense if they think this is sustainable. I'm totally copping out on this question because, like, I could talk myself into any of these outcomes.
Yeah, and I could to a certain extent, too. I answered because I'm not copping out because I'm not scared like you, Nick.
By cowardice.
Yes. Typical lawyer.
Yeah, no, it's true. What would I do with him? I'm kind of terrified it's a mirage. I might just shop him really aggressively and see if I can get anything from him. Although doing that with him is a dead giveaway that I'm convinced it's not real, right? If I'm doing that, like, other front offices aren't stupid.
Yeah.
But some other
front offices are probably stupid.
Either you think it's real or you don't. I think that if he's a going forward, he's a 115. To 120 OPS plus guy, as opposed to the 130 he's at now for reference, with okay defense in a corner. I think you see how open he is to a cheap extension, because if you think he can, because if he's there, then you know, probably keep going.
Yeah. So do we want to read this last question? It's from someone, I don't know who this guy is on Twitter, some really terrible account with a lot of really bad tweets. Shulzy 20. I don't know who this is, but he wants to know how worried we should be about Carlos Rodon.
Other than the fact that he missed half the season with like an injury I never quite understood, I'm not worried at all. He's had 4 starts. He got hit by the Dodgers. They'll do that.
Yeah.
He's walking more guys than I'd like. He hasn't really pitched.
Exactly. And for those not privy to my inside joke, that's Ryan Schultz's question, who BP Southside contributor, who we love very much. Staff writer.
We love him very much, not as much as he loves Carlos Rodon.
That's true. The Dodgers have one of the best offenses in baseball, and they are playing historically good baseball right now.
gave up a few dingers to some like lefty mashing platoon guys, like, yeah. As you recall, Ryan Rayburn used to own Chris Sale,
Kike Hernandez in this case.
Yeah, like, I don't. Obviously, I'd like to see him do better, and there's time for him to do better. But this year, it's kind of. I mean, he missed like 3 months.
If we get to the end of 2017 and there are no signs of his injury flaring up or other injuries popping up, then I think that he had a successful 27. Oh, not successful, but he had a successful time from when he recovered from his injury to the end of the year. If he ends this season with a clean bill of health, I will be happy.
So here's the thing too, is I remember, based on when you ask people the question, different players have different values and they feel different ways. There was a while where people were like, oh, the White Sox made a mistake not taking Schwarber. I don't know if people still feel that way now that
– Yeah.
we're at the current moment in time. I guess Kyle Freeland was also drafted. I'm looking through these other guys. Conforto and Turner, I guess, were the guys. Maybe they quote should have taken, but yeah. I mean, I think Rodon's going to be fine.
Yeah, I don't know. At least they didn't draft Brady Aiken. I mean, come on.
Oh, poor Aiken.
I know.
I wonder if Rodon. I don't think he's ever going to be like what we conceive of as like a number one, but. Just because I don't think the command is ever going to quite be at that level, but
sure.
the stuff's still really good. He's still improving, I think, and I think he'll be an asset through his team control years.
Yeah, it almost seems like the floor for him is higher than it used to be. Like, I'm confident that he's going to be a major league contributor. It's just a matter of him harnessing everything to the point where he can realize his potential. Like, I look at someone like, and maybe this is a terrible comparison, this guy just always pops in my head when it comes to dudes with elite stuff who can't throw strikes, but someone like Danny Salazar in Cleveland, you know, who has never, he's always shown glimpses, but he's never put it together for like prolonged periods of time where it's like you look at him throw and you're like, man, if this dude can like repeat this time and time again, inning to inning, start to start, year to year, he could be like all-stars Cy Young level. And that's kind of how I feel about Rodon, where, you know, we see what he can do when he is on, when he's hitting his spots, when he's commanding the fastball, when he's pitching from ahead. It's like the wipeout slider is already, you know, among the best ones in baseball, and such a weapon. But the key for him is just that he can do it. You know, he can look like he did against the terrible Oakland offense against teams like the Dodgers or even just like the Indians, you know, just repeating it from start to start and from year to year. That's the key for him going forward. But the fact that he still is showing that those signs, even after sitting for several months with an injury, you know, is a good sign. There's still plenty of time. He was drafted 3 years ago. However long ago.
If you're in a fantasy league with Ryan, trade for Rodon.
Yes.
Ryan's panicking. but yeah, I think we're in agreement. Maybe we should disagree more.
We should.
For better to embrace debate, as they say.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's what I had. Unless are there any other non-White Sox related baseball stuff that you wanted to clear your head about, or
no, you know, we bashed the AL Central plenty right there in the middle, so it's always a really zenful experience for me, you know, to just be able to, you know, it's so random. I live in Texas, and three of the baseball fans I talk to on the most regular basis are two Tigers fans and a Royals fan, and so I'm constantly hearing this, and you know, particularly the Tigers fans, like, live and die on every pitch of every Tigers game. And so, you know, I do my trolling nature, but I really am just sick of those fucking teams. So getting to vent with you about them was nice. And other than that, no, I have nothing else, so we can probably call it.
Okay, last question. Who are the wildcard teams in the American League?
I am going to say, man, all right, so I'm going to say Yankees. I think Red Sox in that division. Yankees are winning a wild card. And I'm going to say, fuck.
Right?
Tampa. Tampa is what I'm going with. How about that?
I mean, that seems... They have the best run differentials and best records currently.
Do they? I wasn't even looking at the standings, so that's
of the wild card teams. I assume the Yankees might still keep buying. Pineda got Tommy John or whatever. I don't feel great. I think the Yankees, I feel pretty confident about. Tampa, I don't know.
And maybe this is my bias showing. I just went on that rant about the AL Central. It's like I couldn't bring myself to pick any of these flawed Twins Royals type teams, and the Rangers have completely collapsed, although they somehow still have the second best run differential in the West. don't believe in the Mariners, don't believe in the Angels. So that kind of leaves, I mean, unless you believe that, like, Toronto has a hot streak in them, which is certainly possible. I'd believe in that more than I'd believe in Baltimore.
Yeah, I love – I really all year I just kept saying, like, man, I really still think that the Blue Jays have a run in them. And it's just – they can't quite seem to get everyone healthy at the same time. And
they have a they have the second worst run differential in the entire American League ahead of only Oakland.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, if you look at it, you know, like Aaron Sanchez has only thrown 36 innings. Happ has only thrown 66.
Donaldson missed time with injury. Tulo's been bad. Bautista's been bad for long stretches of time.
Devin Travis can't stay healthy. I guess that's
– and yet they fucking getting all-star years out of Justin Smoke. And, you know, Kevin Pillar has been pretty good for stretches. And Stroman's
Ezekiel
been good.
Ezekiel Cabrera's hitting all. Yeah.
it's like – if you would have gone into the season as a Blue Jays fan and said that, you know, hey, Smoke's going to be an all-star and – Pilar is going to be good, and Ezekiel Carrera is going to be good, and Stroman's going to stay healthy and pitch like a front-end starter all season, you'd have been like, man, we're winning 105 games.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, that's sad. I like those Blue Jays teams. They're fun. But, yeah, I guess the safest bet is Tampa and the Yankees. But I don't know, man. I could see – the thing with the Royals, it was the thing the White Sox always had going, could never quite solve is that. They've been so bad at a couple positions that even a Melky Cabrera could represent like a massive improvement, which might be enough to edge somebody out. I mean, you know, like I said, hope not, but they could. So on that note, I guess I think I have to run. But
yes.
This was a lot of fun, man.
Yes, we will talk to everyone later.